This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm your host for today's conversation. And I'm speaking today with Drs. Ronnie Henrik Andersen and Yanni Lahti. Dr. Andersen is a senior university lecturer of North American Studies at the University of Helsinki, and Dr. Lahti is an Academy of Finland research fellow, also at the University of Helsinki, and together they are the co-editors of a new book entitled Finnish Settler Colonialism in North America, Rethinking Finnish Experiences in Transnational Spaces, which came out with the Helsinki University Press just last year in 2022. Welcome, both of you, to the New Books Network. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for my part as well.
Why don't we begin, as we always do on this show, by just hearing a little bit about who each of you are as authors and as scholars and just as people. Can you each just tell me a bit about your background? And what I'm particularly interested in is how each of you became interested in history.
Okay, so if I'll start, I've been interested in history ever since I was a kid, so that's nothing new. How I came into North American studies was basically studying history at the University of Tampere here in Finland, and starting to do some North American studies topics as well. And I found North American studies really interesting, and the methods and approaches were kind of cool, because you could kind of combine all of my interests like geography, history, cultural studies, religion, and so forth in North American studies, and then going into indigenous studies very, quite early on. And this Finnish history and Finnish immigration history is actually quite late-born interest of mine, so maybe the newest, if you will. But I've been working on indigenous people for many, many years, especially the Lakota on the Northern Plains.
Okay. I was also thinking about looking back. It kind of seems obvious now. As a kid, I was very much interested in Westerns and playing with Western toys and reading Western comics and all that kind of stuff. Of course, I didn't realize that can be made into a career then. But looking at now, I'm closing my 50s. It kind of makes sense that I ended up doing what I've been doing. American West has been my primary interest, especially the Southwest borderlands and the Apaches and the U.S. Army in the 1800s there. Did my dissertation on that at the University of Helsinki back in 2009 already, and been kind of working on those topics of settler colonization, the U.S. Southwest, for many years as well. While Lakani is focused on the Great Plains, my focus is more on the Southwest, but we are both kind of part of this phenomenon in Finland. There's quite a few of historians actually doing North American West here in Finland these days, and it all kind of is a result of one professor who's now retired, Marco Henriksson, who's kind of this pathfinder here in Finland in this field. But that's kind of my story. I've been doing these topics quite a long time. And also, like Rani, Finnish migration history is kind of a late-born interest of mine. And I can talk more about that in a short while as well.
Well, that's actually what I wanted to hear about next is what brought you to this particular topic. Why this question of Finnish immigration and the Finnish experience in North America, and specifically, why look at this question of Finnish immigration experience through the lens of settler colonialism specifically?
Well, the last question is easy because nobody else has done it. I've been studying settler colonization for many years already, and mostly in the North American West, U.S. Southwest borderlands especially. But lately, I've been trying to kind of broaden my perspective as a historian towards more like global history, transnational, transimperial history, and those kind of things. And part of that interest has been a focus on German Southwest Africa, for example, and settler colonization there. And also this Arctic corridor that Finland had from 1920s to 1940s called Petsamo. There's this area that Finns had for two decades and tried to make into a Finnish settler colony and assimilate the Sami people there and all the usual replacement that goes on with settler colonization. So how I come to this book is basically combining my interest in settler colonization around the world and my background in the North American West. And why not combine those two and look at the Finnish experience in North American context, because nobody else has done it before. There's a lot of Finnish migration history, and I don't feel that I'm an expert on Finnish migration history in any part, sense of the word. But I realized, and I know better now, that Finns have been studied in isolation from broader colonization processes in North America. Finns have not been connected to settler colonization in North America. And that was kind of got us into this book, the idea that somebody needs to get the ball rolling, basically. Somebody needs to be the first, somebody needs to get things started. And this is kind of what I imagine as a start in this process. It's by no means a final word, but it's the first kind of systematic investigation of the Finnish experience within a settler colonial framework in North America. Want to add up something, Ronnie, there?
Well, yeah, maybe only that I personally came to this settler colonial and Finns within that context. I had a research project funded by the Kone Foundation, where we studied the Finnish community on a small island, Sugar Island in Michigan, right by the Canadian border, and we did a large network analysis of the Finnish community there, and just started to realize that we are talking about these Finns and their experiences in North America, and there's always the same narrative that comes up, but we don't talk about them, or historians do not talk about them as colonialists, and that's where I kind of started to dig deeper. And then Janne and I had a meeting just out of other coincidence, and we started to talk about this, and this is a topic that somebody should write about or make a book about. So yeah, Janne said, why don't we do it? I said, okay, sure. So it's sometimes just happenstances that bring people together and things start to happen, and this is an important kind of new opening in Finnish discussion about settler colonialism and Finnish role in the larger colonialism debate, if you will.
Yeah, it is. And of course, Ronnie and I have known each other for many years, and we have taught together, and we have organized conferences together, and this kind of opportunity to actually do a book together, an edited volume. But also, like Ronnie mentioned, want to add up something that until the last couple of years, there has been very little on studies on colonialism in the Finnish historical context. Usually, colonialism in Finland is perceived as something that happened far away and a long time ago, and it ended. And that was kind of the perception, prevalent perception a couple of decades ago in other parts of the world as well. But now we realize that colonialism has not ended, that we are still living in an era where colonial heritage and durabilities and legacies are very much part of how the world is organized these days, how the world is functioning these days. And even in Finland these days, like in other Nordic countries, there's been more and more scholars studying colonialism and Finland in different contexts within the Finnish borders, studying Finns in other at the service of other empires in South Africa, in Belgian Congo, or German Southwest Africa, for example, where there were many Finnish missionaries there. But nobody has really connected the Finnish migration histories in North America to studies of colonialism. And we kind of saw an opening there and tried to kind of chip in for our own part.
So it almost sounds like you kind of have a couple different audiences in mind here. On the one hand, you're telling American scholars, you know, like, hey, pay attention to Finnish immigration. When you're talking about settler colonialism in North America, this is an important story too. At the same time, you're talking to Finnish scholars and people in Finland saying, hey, we have a history of colonialism as well that we need to be paying attention to as well. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Especially, I think when we started this book, the main audience would be Finnish people and Finnish scholars, because there are a lot of people who have been studying here Finnish immigration to North America. But they usually, it's a very traditional way of writing about this immigration, and the excuse for not being part of the colonial complex, if you want to use that expression, is that Finland at the time was part of the Russian Empire. So we did not have a governmental colonial process in a way. So we are excluded is the old narrative. We didn't do it. We were good guys. We just immigrated. We didn't colonize anybody. But settler colonialism gives us the framework to analyze that and discuss that too. And also we want to, of course, a lot of Finnish immigrants, descendants in America are interested in Finnish history. And why not the general audience as well? While Finnish immigration numbers are not, people migrating maybe not that great as some others, but still had a great impact on certain areas in North America.
So this was a almost wholly new topic for me, which are often my favorite kind of books to cover on this show. I love the excuse to learn a bunch of new stuff about something that I wasn't familiar with before. And, well, I don't usually ask my guests all that much about historiography when they come on the show. I am a little bit curious about the process of putting together this edited volume. How did you decide on what scholars should contribute to this book? And I guess in a broader sense, I'm wondering about what the sort of landscape is. Are there a lot of scholars that are working on questions like these, the history of Finnish people in North America or Finnish colonialism broadly?
I think there. Go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of scholars, as I said, who have studied immigration history per se, as a, you know, looking at what Finns did in North America, part of labor movements and working class people. There's a new, younger generation of scholars, younger than us, who are looking at broader contexts and different kinds of topics and using different methodologies to explore that. And we wanted to tap into that source as well. We approached a lot of younger scholars to work with us who actually did, and older as well. And we approached many others who are not part of this book, who couldn't contribute for many reasons, time-wise and whatnot. But there is a bunch of younger scholars who are doing a really interesting work right now. Janne, you might want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, that's true as well. Like you mentioned previously, Finns don't perceive themselves as colonizers, and this kind of historical perception, like you already mentioned, it relates to us being a part of the Russian Empire until 1917. And when I was kind of getting into these topics of Finland and colonialism, one of the reactions I usually get is that it doesn't apply to us, or at least we were victims of colonization, meaning that we were victims of Russian colonization. But that doesn't, you can have many kind of different roles. Finns can apply many different kinds of historical roles in different historical contexts, and that's why it's so interesting to study Finns in at the service of other empires, as merchants, as explorers, scientists, as settlers, trying to kind of, they have access, they can gain part of and become part of those cultures themselves. But there's a lot of there's more and more scholars. I would say there are a lot of scholars working on these topics these days, but there are more and more, especially of the younger generation, who are questioning these old, very kind of conservative migration histories here, and asking new questions, connecting Finnish experiences to these global histories of colonialism, and its different shapes and forms. And that's, we knew some of the people we wanted to be part of this book. Some of them luckily were able to contribute, others were too busy to participate. But we could kind of tap into our network and resources of people, and then some of those people knew other people who could become good contributors, and that's how this came about. We were contemplating a general call for papers at some point, but then we realized that we actually have enough of by just tapping into our networks and connections here in Finland, trying to get a diverse group of people studying history from different, and North America from different perspectives. So this is very kind of multi-generational, but also interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary collection of authors here, not only historians, but people who are from area and culture studies, from literature, and other fields as well.
So before we get too much further in our conversation, I'm thinking that maybe we should kind of pause and define a term here. Can you provide, this is going to be it's going to be a short question, but a difficult question. Can you maybe provide a bit of an overview as to what exactly you mean by settler colonialism? A lot of our listeners might be kind of vaguely aware of what this term means. It gets thrown around a lot, but maybe we should just kind of take a second and actually define what exactly it is that we are talking about. What is settler colonialism, and how is it different from other forms of colonialism?
You're right, that settler colonialism is kind of this trendy, or at least it has been for a while, it's kind of trendy term to throw around, trendy topic. I've been thinking about settler colonialism a lot, especially lately. I just took over as the chief editor of the journal Settler Colonial Studies for Taylor and Francis, and as an editor, I kind of feel the need that I need to be on top of the field. I need to understand the field, what settler colonialism is, and there are a couple of different ways of approaching it. But it's to me, it's a form of colonialism that goes beyond what typical colonialism does. Typical colonialism is about exploitation of resources, extraction of labor. Settler colonization is more than that. It involves both of those things as well. But settler colonization is about, it's about land. It's about replacement, substitution. It's about going into somebody else's land and making it your own. So that's basically what settler colonialism is. It's about a contest for land. It's about native elimination, replacement of those who are already there by a new set of peoples. And as part of that process, settler colonization is also about claiming settlers as indigenous. It's about, and this happens usually through narrations, through stories, because settlers are new to the place. They just need, they have this urge to create narratives that kind of make their claim for the land more substantial. So basically, settlers don't just say that we just got here and took this land, but rather they make claims that this land made us and we made this land. So as if history starts with the settlers arriving, that there's nothing before that. This kind of very kind of arrogant way of approaching the past. But silicon is that's what silicon is. It's about taking the land and making claims on that land that you belong to that particular place. So settler is very different than migrant. Migrant is a person who moves into somebody else's land and adopts, assimilates, tries to kind of blend in. Of course, that doesn't mean that he or she forgets his or her old culture. But settler goes to somebody else's land and takes over, makes it his or her own, and replaces those who are already there. So settler and migrant are very kind of different things. So that's my understanding of settler colonization, a form of colonism that aims to replace people who are already there and make the land their own.
Ronnie, anything you want to add to Yanni's pretty thorough definition there?
No, that was actually a good definition and a bit of a concept.
I thought so too.
Yeah. One thing that I could add, one part of that process is also place naming. And I'm pretty intrigued about naming places. And that's, of course, a big debate in North America right now, what place names we are using. But like in the cover of our book, you can see Finnish town names in an American map of Michigan. And that's part of the process too, to make the place familiar by renaming it. There's Toivola, there's actually a place called Finland in Minnesota. Just to make it familiar and make it your own and make you belong into that particular place, even through place name. So that is something that intrigues me a lot.
Yeah, that's very much part of that process as well. I was visiting Namibia last fall, and there are towns called Swakopmund or Lüderitz. There's the old German place names. There are mountains named after Germans there still. And of course, Germans haven't been the rulers there for 100 years. But the German settlers are still there. Their descendants are still there. And they are very kind of formidable part of that society. So settlers are trying to make their claims through place naming. And sometimes, even if the formal settler colonization ends or fails, the settlers still stay, and they still hold that kind of narrative and that kind of power, which is kind of very interesting phenomenon as well.
Can you describe a bit about the Finnish experience in North America in kind of a very broad sense? I'm thinking about questions like where were Finnish people arriving when they came to North America? What were some of the hubs of immigration? How many Finnish people were coming to these places? When were they arriving? And then again, kind of broadly speaking, what were their experiences like? I mean, is it even possible to generalize in asking a question like this?
Yeah, it's a good question in the sense that that's something that the Finnish immigration to North America narrative have always been like. It's about generalizations, that people come and they become part of the land and they get along really well with the natives, whether it's the first colonies in Delaware in 1630s or 40s, when the first Finns came over through Sweden and then to the United States. Well, not the United States then, of course, but North America or the British colonies. But it's been part of the narrative that they had the similar experience. And later on, late 19th century, early 20th century, they came to mostly to Michigan, Minnesota, and the Northwest Coast, where they would be part of the labor movements and working in the mines or in forestry industry and so on, which is all true. But there are, of course, different experiences in different areas. And a lot of the Finns in Northwest Coast, for example, Oregon, Washington, they were working in the fishing industry, in the canning business. So these, but mostly labor, middle class and lower middle class people moving into North America. But to kind of generalize is always difficult and unfair in a way. But I think this narrative about the benevolent Finn that we talk about in the book as well has been going on ever since, that we get along with the natives. We did not take the land. We just became part of the country. It's a story that still resonates today with many, many people. Janne, would you like to comment?
I was looking at this idea that Finns try to make claims that they are exceptional. That they are exceptional colonizers, although not colonizers at all. But that when you look at these narratives of exceptionalism more closely, you realize that everybody did it. Everybody wanted to be a good colonizer or not colonizer. Nobody wanted to be a bad colonizer, even at the time. And looking at German history, looking at, of course, U.S. history, exceptionalism is a very strong narrative, and it still resonates in many parts of the culture and the society and its history. And Finns also have this kind of tendency that we were not that bad, that we didn't take the land, that we were good colonizers, we were good people, and this close relationship with nature that Finns claim they have was also seen as making them more and more effeminate and have a better relationship with Native Americans. And of course, in some cases, that there was some hint of truth there. There were some traditions that made them more closer to the Native peoples than perhaps some other groups who came from more industrial and urban areas in Europe. Because Finns at the time were a very kind of rural society still, 100 years ago. Most Finns lived in the countryside, and they had kind of personal experience of life in the countryside and how to deal with nature on a day-to-day basis, unlike people from Germany or England, where people have lived in cities for a couple of generations already. But yeah, that's the...
Yeah, that's a big part of the narrative, is that Finns were, you know, closer to the natives because we have the sauna or the sweat lodge that many native people have still, and we would have similar ideas of how to be in the nature, with the nature and environment. And there's also the topic of that's not discussed that often, land ownership, the concept of land. When Finns or Swedes, when they came in the 17th century, for example, when they made a treaty with the local native people about land, for example. So the Finns and Swedes still allowed natives to maybe hunt on the land that was now Swedish or Finnish, whereas the British would not, no trespassing. The Finns had already then, as we still do, have a common right, what is it called, common every man's right to land, so you can
everyone's
go and hunt,
right.
And
yeah,
you can, every man's right, so you can go and pick berries or mushrooms or whatever you want on anybody's land, you can camp anywhere, and that was already part of the culture then, which is very different from the British, who, when you make a treaty with the natives, this is your land, this is my land, you have no access to mine anymore. That did not apply, so that maybe is kind of a start to the narrative that we got along better with the indigenous people than the rest. And some others, Janne mentioned some other things. And there's a hint of truth to all of that. So let's not get rid of all the myths immediately. Just think about them a little bit more in detail and in depth.
I'm wondering if you can provide some specific examples on this question of Finnish settler and native relationships. I thought this was a really fascinating part of the book that a couple of the essays in the collection addressed. So what are some examples of the various kinds of relationships and interactions that Finnish settlers and indigenous people in North America had? I'm thinking about places like Michigan. I know that there's a chapter that Ronnie, I believe you contributed to about, you mentioned earlier, Sugar Island. But there's other examples throughout the book as well that are also very telling.
Sure, Rani can talk about Sugar Line and Michigan, but there are many different places. Of course, Finns went. They took advantage of Homestead Act. They took the allotment era. Finns went to different places and tried to kind of build their societies. And they actually ended up taking indigenous lands like other European groups did as well. And this happened, of course, there's different historical context, different ways of doing this. Some went to lease indigenous lands on the reservations, for example, in Minnesota. Others took part of the land sessions in other places. Also in Arizona, for example, when the copper mining industry got going in the late 1800s, Finns were an essential part of the labor force of the big mining companies who took the lands to establish mines on Apache lands, for example. But Finns were also part of these processes from British Columbia all the way to Cuba, when the U.S. acquired Cuba in the war against Spain. There were notions and attempts to establish Cuba as a white settler colony, and many Finnish people imagined that would be one place where Finns could settle. There was this newspaper publisher called Eero Erkko, and Finland was not independent yet. He was very kind of this nationalist mindset. He was imagining that the Russian influence would destroy Finnish kind of this nationhood, that Finns needed a safe place to be Finns, essentially, and Cuba would be that place, but it didn't materialize. There were some attempts to establish Finnish colony there, but it didn't last. And of course, Finns gained independence in 1917, a decade or so after Erkko imagined these Finnish colonies in Cuba. But there are different ways of approaching this. One of these interesting things is that Finland was not independent, but Finland had this growing sense of nationhood and this nationalist feeling. And David would imagine that Russians would never allow Finns to be an independent nation. So Finns needed to go somewhere else to become Finns, to fulfill their national kind of national feeling. And North America would allow that as communities could thrive there and still retain their Europeanness. Of course, there were a lot of contradictions there. But I also noticed that the Germans had these kind of similar notions in the 1800s. There was even this word called Auslanddeutsche, which basically means Germans abroad. But wherever you were in the world, North America, West, Brazil, Shanghai, you were still a German. And you retained your Germanness. But of course, that also was kind of a fabrication, and assimilation, especially in North America, was very strong among Germans and Finns. In a few generations, Finns kind of the melting pot idea at least for some of them.
I could add one interesting when you talk about Finnish and indigenous people and relationships. There's a lot of the people in Michigan and Minnesota and that area who call themselves Findians, so like Findians, and who are descendants of Finns and native people marrying each other. And they are really proud about that heritage, and they feel strongly about their Finnish heritage, and they feel really strongly about their indigenous heritage. So these smaller places, or let's say Sugar Island, kind of place that is an island and easily defined, these intermarriages happened a lot, and Finns and indigenous people did get along pretty well in certain areas, and some of the articles in our book talk about that too. So we are not only talking about antagonism and that kind of stuff. Also, you know, in the artwork, or Cowboy, I think, who calls him defines himself Findian, if I am not mistaken, proudly exhibits this tradition in his artwork, and also in the images in the book.
That's a very good point. I just want to add that settler colonization is about replacement and substitution, but of course real life on an individual level is much more complex, and a lot of different types of interactions happen. People meet, people fall in love, people hate each other, whatever, this life happens. And of course our theoretical models like settler colonization, and while it seems plausible and it makes sense, and it as a historical process we can see that this replacement and substitution is happening, native elimination is happening through warfare or boarding schools or whatever, but still there are nuances, there are still complex histories and complex human experiences and a lot of interaction and a lot of these kind of fluid identities are being made, and people sometimes at least people can kind of relate to different cultures. Sometimes they need to choose whether they are Finns or Indians, but sometimes they can be Finn Indians, at least even after generations have passed.
Ronnie, there's a chapter that you contributed to the end of the book that I thought was really interesting about Finnish immigrants, and about two in particular, and this sort of like interplay and connection and cross-section between Finnish immigration and leftist politics in the United States, but also in Europe in the early 20th century, and how it relates to settler colonialism. Can you explain this story a bit and how it connects to the overall theme of the book?
Well, I tried to be brief. Yeah, this is an interesting thing. This chapter of ours looks at two Finnish immigrants called Frank Aaltonen and Oskari Tokoi. The part of Oskari Tokoi is based and written by a friend of mine, a colleague, Dr. Rainer Smedman, who has been, he's probably the leading historian in Finland looking at Oskari Tokoi. So we wrote that together. And Frank, I'll start with Frank Aaltonen though. He emerged in our research on Sugar Island as a key figure, Finnish figure on the island. He moved to the U.S. in 1905, and he had been really powerful leftist politician and agitator, as they call him. He went around the country to call for, you know, socialists to work together. And he said that the place of Finn is not in the mines. He needs to have he's free on his land and so on. So really kind of nationalistic idea. Then in 1915, he went to Sugar Island, Michigan. And he saw that as a free place. He completely bought into the narrative of free land and, you know, if you will, the American expansion to the West, free land there to be taken. And he saw the land as a place where a Finnish community could thrive. And he started to develop the island and invite other Finns to come to the island. And they actually made a huge success on the island, replacing not only the native people, there had been other French and other people for centuries on the island, but there were still native communities there, and the Finns just basically took over a lot of the island, cut the forests and made their home. It's like what happened in Finland too. I mean, cutting the forest was something Finns could do a lot and make it a farmland. So that's what Frank Aaltonen became a powerhouse on the island, and they still talk about him fondly on the island. And Oskari Tokoi then, he was a known politician in Finland, a socialist, never a communist, a socialist. But he has an interesting family history. He was in the U.S. already in the 1870s, just after the so-called Plains Indian Wars, after Wounded Knee. And he was in the Black Hills, and he was in the Southwest. And the way he talks about the indigenous people is really paternalistic. He buys into this narrative that Finns are an exceptional minority and people who really deserve to take the land and so on. He comes back to Finland and becomes actually the first prime minister of Finland. But then a revolution happens. Finland becomes independent. He gets a death sentence after our own civil war from the winning party, the Whites, and then also from the communists, and flees to America illegally and meets Frank Aaltonen in Sault Ste. Marie, Canada, and goes to the U.S. Across the border without permission and becomes an illegal alien in the United States and befriends Frank Aaltonen. And then they start these socialist discussions about what is it to be a Finn in North America. And eventually, after World War II, they create help from America to Finland. Interesting histories, but how it ties to settler colonialism, Frank Aaltonen actually settles and colonizes Sugar Island, whereas Oskari Tokoi goes from place to place in North America, meets native people, and kind of is a expression of the settler colonial sentiment, if you will. That's a good way to express it. He really epitomizes the idea of what it is to be a settler colonial Finn. So these two interesting people per se, and then you bring them together and look at their histories in the context of settler colonialism and socialism. It's a different view on the whole immigration story, I think.
There's another chapter toward the end of the book that really stood out to me about the migration of Sami people, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, to North America, that I, again, found really interesting. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the Sami experience and what it means in the author's words to be, quoting the article here, to be both indigenous and settler in North America.
I think the article nicely captures this kind of fluid identity is this kind of paradox of settler colonization, where people can make claims for whiteness and then they can make claims for indigenousness at different parts or different times in different settings. The Sami arrived, like the author of the article, Erik Hiata, he makes a great case here that the Sami arrived for the gold rush in Alaska, for the reindeer, for their specific skills in reindeer herding and transportation services for the gold rush, so they arrived in the late 1800s, more in the early 1900s, and at the time the Sami people were not identified usually often as separate from Finns. They were in North America. Many claimed identities as white, many passed as white in North America because whiteness was social power. It benefited the Sami to make claims for whiteness in North America. Of course, Sami situation here in Finland at the time was very much the opposite. They were being discriminated. They were targeted by a growing sentiment of assimilation. They were also seen as a vanishing race, like Native Americans in North America. Here in Finland, they would imagine that the Sami would disappear and vanish in a generation or two when they met white Finnish culture in our northern parts, today called Lapland. And in North America, they could kind of escape this situation that they were experiencing in Finland and become white. But then, like Erik Hieta here in the article very nicely puts, after a couple of generations, they could kind of rediscover their heritage. They could more and more... Finns who have this Sami connection in North America are rediscovering that, and they are kind of rediscovering their roots, they're rediscovering their shared indigenous identity, together making connections with the Sami communities here in Northern Europe, especially in Finland, but other places in Northern Europe as well, but also making connections with the indigenous communities in North America, and storytelling, environmental activism, all these kind of facets are very much an integral part of this Sami experience in North America. So it's a very kind of fascinating article on how people can... how people's identities can shape and shift over time, how people can be part of this settler colonization process as both settlers and indigenous, making claims for both sides of the narrative, if you will. But also, it just shows that the narrative, we shouldn't be stuck with these kind of opposites. We should kind of dig in more deep and see how complex histories really are.
Another major theme that I see running through this book is the creation of culture, and culture of all different kinds, as a means of building identity and building community among Finnish immigrants. It really ties into this idea of complexity that I'm seeing and hearing you both talk about a lot as we work our way through this book. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about the role of culture creation, specifically things like literature, biography and autobiography writing, myth-making of all kinds of forms of culture, building as ways that Finnish people were trying to make sense of and find a place in North America as settlers.
Yeah, I think culture is a really important theme here, and what of course we define how to define culture is of course different, and the Finnish American culture probably in Connecticut is different from Michigan, different from what it is in the Northwest, and so on. So against generalizations are difficult to make, but just thinking about biographies, for example, that is a powerful way of making claim as well to the land and to this place where you are. And both Frank Aaltonen, for example, and Oskari Tokko wrote memoirs and biographies. Frank Aaltonen is not published. We found it in an archive in Berkeley. And he talks in the biography how Finns belong to Sugar Island. And I think this is very common elsewhere as well. I haven't read that many biographies, but I could see that in Oskari Tokko's and Frank Aaltonen, how they kind of create this narrative of the righteousness of Finns being on that particular place. And it's interesting how Frank Aaltonen, for example, talks about different race ethnicities, I should call, how he talks about what he calls full-blood Indians and half-blood and mixed bloods and whatnot, and how these are different, how they had different characteristics and so on. So completely racist discussion, considering from our perspective at least, in 21st century. But this relates to the story of the Finns and how we are part of that place. And that relates to the myth-making as well, how the Finnish migration becomes a myth of beautiful relations and so on. So this also goes to literature. There's of course a plethora of Finnish Americans writing about Finnish history and novels and so on, and it's all part of that not nation building but building of self or identity in a new country. Maybe Janne, you would like to elaborate on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think your good point is that Finns used literature, they used biography to make claims for themselves within the North American context. They make claims for Finnishness within this North American context. And there's one article in the book by Johannes Kurnik who also argues that maps did much the same, that map making was one way of making space, one way of making claims that the space was available, that there were free land, and also one way of making claims that Finns were there, that the Finnish place names, Finnish presence was an integral part of this North American experience. And rather than separate themselves, I think these cultural facets here that we're talking about just to prove that Finns were an essential part of this settler colonization, that they were part of these processes where they were naming places, they were creating narratives, they were gaining access to the land, they were making claims that the land was available. They were kind of making this whole settler colonization narration that allowed them to be part of this process, that allowed replacement seem normal or even obvious, that allowed them to feel that they had the right to be there, that they were belonging there. Belonging is very kind of important here as well. Throughout the book, Finns belonging is an integral part of what the Finns were trying to do. They were trying to justify their presence. They were justify that they were as good colonizers, for lack of a better word, than the other Europeans were there as well. And of course, also part of this, while it's not implicitly addressed in any of the other articles, is the claims for whiteness. In the late 1800s, the whiteness of Finns was questioned. There were questions if Finns were truly European or Asiatic. And participation in this North American settler colonization was one way for Finns to prove their whiteness, to make claims for whiteness. And like I said previously, at the time, whiteness was power, and whiteness was privilege. And that Finns were trying to kind of even create their place within the European mosaic of North America. They were equal to Germans, equal to Swedes, and so forth.
Yeah, and I would continue a couple of articles in the book by Roman Kushner, and I think it was Sirpa Salenius who wrote about, correct me if I'm wrong, Jan, I don't have the book with me here today, but about literature and how Finns and natives have been portrayed in literature all the way, literature discussing or portraying the 17th century Finnish immigration to Delaware area and also later on in the Canadian forests and so on. So literature played a huge role in this myth making and also the establishment of Finnishness in North America.
Absolutely, and there's this historiographies as well. By we have an article by Johanna Leinonen on historiographies, and then we have an article by Sami Kasarama on life writing, basically memoirs and these kind of shorter stories on how settlers are making claims through historiographical scientific writing, but also through this kind of more personal narratives of their space within these contexts of settler colonization.
And Jani, you ended up kind of getting the last word in the book. The last chapter is an article written by you, and I actually thought it served as a pretty interesting and well-placed capstone to this project that you both helped create here. And it's an article about a specific Finnish person, Finnish immigrant, and his travels throughout the American West specifically. So can you talk a bit about this story, maybe explain who exactly Gustav Nordenskjold was, and how he speaks to not just issues in the past in indigenous and settler relations, but also to how these stories are still playing out in the present as well.
Yeah, thanks. Gustav Nordenskjold was a scientist, an aspiring scientist who went to Mesa Verde in 1891. And he was on a world tour. He was suffering from tuberculosis, and he was seeking for a cure. And part of that cure was going to different types of climates. And of course, he came from a very established family. His father was Adolf Erik Nordenskjold, a famous, world-famous explorer at the time, who had discovered the Northeast Passage across the Arctic Sea, and the family also had other explorers and scientists there. And Gustav was kind of aspiring to make a name for himself, and he stumbled on Mesa Verde, and he saw an opportunity there. He was in his early 20s. He gathered a large collection of artifacts, even including human remains from Mesa Verde, 600 items altogether. He wrote very different kinds of publications of Mesa Verde and the ancient Pueblon cultures there. And he also tried to make claims that he was kind of recreating this history of the Southwest, where the Mesa Verde exemplified this ancient civilization that the current indigenous peoples, the Apaches, Navajos, Utes, had brought down, and there was an era of chaos there, and the U.S. and its colonization was bringing light and civilization to this chaos. But Gustav Nordenskiöld was a privileged European scientist who basically didn't give a damn about his rights. He was arrested for a while, and the reservation agent for the Southern Utes forbid him to dig anything from the reservation, and then the local judge also denied Gustav any right to take any human remains out of the country, but he did both. And he was kind of exemplifying this, he was a man of his times, in a way. The era, the European science, many of the European fields of scholarship at the time took advantage of the rest of the world. They saw that they had the right to take these items, even human remains, for scientific study in Europe, that they had the right to collect museum collections of indigenous artifacts, that they had the right to remove these items, the items had been in the Southwest for generations already. And they also made claims that the current Pueblo peoples, while they were perhaps descendants of the Mesa Verde people, there was this disconnect there, that the current Pueblos were not really up to the standards of the Mesa Verde people. And Gustav he got his collection. He shipped it, the 600 items, to Sweden, but he was in debt. So he had the Finnish financier came to his help, but both died very soon. And the collection ended up in the Finnish National Museum, where 90% of the collection still is. 10% was returned in 2020 to the Pueblo people, to the Pueblo delegation led by the Hopi, after a few years of making claims for their repatriation. The repatriation process is a very interesting thing itself, because it really got going only after the U.S. federal government asked the Finnish government that could it actually happen. Then the Finnish National Museum got going. But like I said, 10% of the items were returned, especially, to my understanding, all the human remains were returned in 2020, and other burial artifacts. But of course, this also speaks to these legacies and durabilities of colonialism we see all over the world today. Of the role of museum, the repatriation processes and claims. There have been many repatriation claims throughout Western Europe these days. The British Museum has been receiving those. The new Humboldt Forum in Berlin. There's a lot of debate in Germany on what to do with the colonial artifacts. And there are hundreds of items throughout Germany. And of course, Mesa Verde as such is also an interesting place. Of course, it's a very popular national park these days. I was actually there last week for the second time. The first time was 20 years ago. And I could still see in the bookstore Gustav Nordenskiöld's book on the cliff dwellers of the Mesa Verde. And I took a look at the book, and there were still these Gustav's drawings of Crania there in the last pages. They were not removed in the latest edition, so that kind of was shocking in a way. But there's very little else on Gustav there in the Mesa Verde, and the Mesa Verde narrative was very different than it was 20 years ago. Today, saw a couple of those films they show for the tourists there, and there's a lot of emphasis on the Pueblo perspectives, and the emphasis there is on continuities and connections that the modern Pueblos have with the Mesa Verde people. Of course, Gustav Nordenskjöld was building a very different story of disconnects between the past and the present. So that was fascinating to see. But Gustav Nordenskjöld exemplifies this what I would call a second wave of decolonization going on in the world. If the first wave of decolonization is the independence process after World War II, when countries in Africa and Asia especially gained independence, our second wave, currently ongoing, is targeting Western knowledge, Western education, Western ways of understanding history, the present and the past, and how we perceive ourselves and our role in the world, and how we could better combat and address global inequalities, whether they relate to museums and repatriation, or to environmental issues, or statues, or whatever. But Gustav is very much part of that debate ongoing still around the world.
And as we begin to wrap up here, I always like toward the end of my interviews to sort of flip the script a little bit and ask my guests to imagine themselves as a reader of their book, thinking back on this book from some point in the future, a few years down the line. What would you hope that this reader remembers or comes away from this book understanding about history? What do you think that would be?
Well, with this particular book, I think I would like people to understand that history is complex. Human experience is complex, and there are different ways of understanding the world around you by different peoples from representing different cultures, ethnicities, and whatnot. And we may have a kind of theoretical framework, say like colonialism, that allows us researchers to focus on these things and maybe challenge some old myths and stereotypes and what have you. But the stories are not always pretty, and they are complicated, and there are many different perspectives to understand, to create a story of a people or in this case, a group of immigrants.
Yeah, you make very good points about the complexity, Rani, and I could fully agree there. If I need to say something else, we talked about the audience for this book, that we're talking to North American audience and the Finnish audience. I would like both of them to realize that Finns were part of the settler colonization process, the settler colonization histories and the present in North America. In all its complexity, that Finns were there. They were part of those complex historical trajectories, and Finns participated in as settlers, as scientists, through literature, map making, all these different facets. Finns were a quintessential part, along many others. There was nothing exceptional about Finns. That also what I would like to make claims about. But Finns were part of that process. And also, in a few years down the line, I would hope to see other books on the topic as well to come out, that this would be a kind of an opening to further scholarship. And I trust it is. I trust there's more things to come. I know, I hope there is.
And then finally, I always like to also get a preview from my guests about what they are working on next. So Jani, why don't we start with you? What have you been working on since the publication of this book? What's coming down the road for you?
There's quite a lot of things, but I can pick up a couple. I also received quite a large foundation fund from Kone Foundation focusing on Petsamo, the Finnish Arctic settler colony, and I hope to write the first academic monograph of that in a couple of years. Also, like I said, I went to Mesa Verde last week, and the bookstore didn't have a book on Gustav Nordenskjöld at the Mesa Verde there, a modern scholarly work on Gustav Nordenskjöld at the Mesa Verde, and that would be really great to write a book, a monograph on that as well. So perhaps those two things are on the top of my current list, but the list is long.
Jani, I feel like I'm always seeing your name pop up in places. You're a very prolific guy, I've noticed over the years. Ronnie, how about you?
Yeah, I've got a lot of things. I got a couple of big projects that ended last year, one on the history of the Lakota and one on national parks in a global context. And that's something that I'm going to continue with. I actually recently last week, a couple of weeks ago, got a research project funding from the Academy of Finland to look on national parks and indigenous people and looking at different ways of collaboration between administrative agencies of indigenous people in North America and Scandinavia. So that is something I'm going to be working on at least for the next 4 years. And hopefully that will take me to some cool national parks in the U.S.
Always a good excuse to travel, right?
Yeah, right. So yeah, there's a lot of work.
Dr. Ronnie Henrik Andersson is Senior University Lecturer of North American Studies at the University of Helsinki, and Dr. Jani Lahti is an Academy of Finland Research Fellow also at the University of Helsinki. And together, they are the co-editors of the new book, Finnish Settler Colonialism in North America, Rethinking Finnish Experiences in Transnational Spaces, which came out with Helsinki University Press last year in 2022. Thank you so much for joining me today, both of you. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for having us. It was great.